This morning, we're going to be back in the book of Daniel. Last week, we were in Daniel 1. This week, we will be in Daniel 2. We're looking at stories from exile because I spent 2 months telling you I think that's the trajectory the church is on, that we're going to enter into, or may already have entered into, an experience that, if we're going to use biblical categories, would best be described as exile. And what I'm hoping to do is give you some encouragement by telling you stories of people who actually lived these experiences, people who went through exile. And what I believe the book of Daniel does, especially in the first six chapters, is it paints a picture for what is possible in situations that are like exile. And what Daniel chapter 1 showed us last week is that it's actually possible not just to survive in exile, but actually to thrive. It is actually entirely possible to work in the king's court, to walk in halls of pagan power, and maintain your integrity without compromise. It is in fact possible in exile to be both successful and holy. I don't know about you, but if you think like I think that we're probably headed into an exilic experience, that's really good news. That's really encouraging. But what Daniel chapter 2 is going to tell us is while it might be possible, it doesn't mean it's going to be easy. The story opens in the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Remember, this is Nebuchadnezzar the Great. This is the Nebuchadnezzar who had his image carved on a big rock and it said, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, king of the universe. That guy with that ego. It's in the second year of his reign. History tells us that his reign began shortly after his victory at Carchemish. Carchemish was the last stand of the Assyrian Empire. They were mostly defeated at this point, but this was the last stand, and Egypt was going to come help. Egypt's the other big power player at this time, and maybe Assyria and Egypt can defeat the Babylonians. They do not. It is a failure of epic proportion. Babylon is now the world superpower, but within a few weeks of Carchemish, Nebuchadnezzar receives word that his father, back home in the capital city, has died. He has to immediately rush home so that he can take the throne. He was named the crown prince, but he's got some brothers who, if he waits too long, will be more than happy to take the throne. At this time, these leaders had to be perceived as strong, as successful, because in these empires, the king was expendable. There was always a general or a religious political leader or another prince who, if you appeared weak, they would be more than happy to have you assassinated and ascend to the throne in power. And in fact, this happened many, many times. He's early in his reign, and he needs to demonstrate that he is strong, successful, and competent. And so you can understand when you have to look these things and you deal with the insecurities that every leader has, your anxiety level's about up here. And it seems that his anxiety has entered into his dreams and disturbed his sleep. Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. The king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dream. So they came in and stood before the king, and the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. It's an interesting phrase in English. It's also interesting, ambiguous in the Hebrew. I am troubled to know the dream. It's your dream. Don't you know your dream? And the ambiguity here leaves open, I think, two different interpretations. One that I think is probably the more traditional or the more common anyhow is that what he means by this is that he had a dream and he wants to know what it means. That's what he's getting at when he says, I want to know my dream. But when you read most of the Bible commentators, what they all seem to suggest is that what he actually did was forgot his dream. Has this ever happened to you? Have you ever woken up in the morning and you know you had a bad dream? Like maybe you wake up in a cold sweat, you feel anxious, all the feelings of the dream are still there, and you're just like, oh, that wasn't good. But then when you try to think about what exactly wasn't good, you can't quite put your finger on it. The dream itself eludes you, though you know how you feel about it. Has that happened to you? I woke up this morning, my alarm went off in the middle of a dream, and so my dream was interrupted. And what I've realized is, right now, I can't tell you what I was dreaming. I've got some vague inclination about it, but I really don't remember the details. And this is a problem in the ancient world. Because dreams often pointed to realities beyond themselves, but if you forgot the dream, it was considered a bad omen. The dream was given so that you would know what is about to come to pass or be given some sort of insight, but if you forget the dream, well, you're out of luck, aren't you? So he's anxious to know his dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show you the interpretation. A couple comments on this verse. If you see this word showing up, Chaldean, a couple different times, you might be wondering, well, what exactly is a Chaldean? Now, in most contexts in Scripture, Chaldean, it's an ethnic term. It would be no different than Babylonian or Jewish. It describes a people group. You get it early in the book of Genesis. Abram and Sarai are called and they leave Ur of the Chaldeans. So what we find out in Genesis is that, well, Abraham's not Israelite, is he? Because Israel is his grandson. There are no Israelites. Abraham is Chaldean. But in Daniel, it's different. In Daniel, Chaldean is a very specific technical term. It's kind of a big basket that Daniel throws the sorcerers and the magicians and the astrologers. All of those fit in this basket he calls Chaldeans. If we were to translate it into modern English, the better way of saying it, we might be experts or wise guys, or the Persians would call them magi. Not too dissimilar from prophets in Israel. These are the guys who know things. They traffic in the information that reaches into the spiritual realm. They're the experts and they're the advisors. They're the guys who are supposed to provide all the answers that the king is looking to find. That's the Chaldeans. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show you the interpretation. Because that's how this works. What we found archaeologically is what they've called dream books. They are extensive catalogs, records of dreams that important people had and the subsequent events that followed the dreams. And they're laid right next to each other so that when anybody else has a dream, you just go looking through the catalog to find similar imagery. And once you've identified the imagery of the dream, then you can relate it to past events and conclude that the future will be similar to the past. That's how this works. So tell us the dream. We'll go dig through the catalog, and then we'll tell you what your dream means. Unless he can't remember it. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word for me is firm. Boys, let me make myself clear. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid to ruin. Seems a little excessive. But if you show me the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honors. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. They answered a second time and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation. Boss, that's not how this works. So the king answered and said, I know with certainty that you're trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. The king looks at his wise guys, thinks they're all playing for time, and maybe they are, but he does not relent. And he is being unreasonable, but understand what he's asking. He wants to know that these guys can tell him something more than just anybody else. What he wants to know is, do you have an answer that just doesn't come from some old dusty textbook? I could have read the book myself if I had been bothered to. I want more than that. Do you have anything more? That's your job. And the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demands. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. This whole story pivots on that response. Did you catch the repetition? No man, no king, and no one but the gods. No one can do what you're asking. It's not possible. And no great king has ever asked such a thing. This is a very subtle way of telling Nebuchadnezzar the Great, you ain't so great, because you're being unreasonable. Because what you want to know, only the gods know. And they're not wrong. And they don't dwell here with us. They don't live in the neighborhood, and we can't ask. It's an insightful comment, isn't it? Well, Nebuchadnezzar, obviously, he's angry, and he freaks out. Not least of which because all of his wise guys tell him he's not that great. He probably didn't appreciate that. But they're not able to deliver the more that he's looking for. You understand that every leader, we said this last week, is looking for solutions because every leader in any organization has a plate of problems that they're looking to solve. They're not out looking for other problems, we should remember that. They're looking for solutions and people who can provide solutions. And the bigger the organization, the nation, or the empire, the greater the degree of anxiety the leader deals with as they address the uncertain and unknown in the future. Every leader is looking for that edge. They're trying to find a way to peek around the corner before everybody else so that they can anticipate what is coming, plan accordingly, and be successful. And anybody who can help them take the peek around the corner or get an idea of what the future holds just a little quicker than anybody else will be exalted and given great rewards. This isn't just Nebuchadnezzar. It's all leaders. This happened in Israel. It was the story of Ahab and Jehoshaphat. Ahab is king of Israel, the northern kingdom. Jehoshaphat is king of Judah, the southern kingdom. And they were in an alliance. They're planning on going into battle. What do? They bring all the prophets in. Why? Because they want to know what's going to happen before it happens. They want to know, if we go to battle, are we going to be successful? Ask the gods. And all the prophets say, oh yes, you will be successful. You will smash and destroy your enemies. And then Jehoshaphat, he looks around and says, wait a minute. Are there no prophets of Yahweh that we can inquire of him also? Ahab says, yeah, I got one, but I don't like him. He never says anything nice. Well, go get him. So he gets him and he says, yeah, you're not going to be successful in battle. And then they ignore him and they go into battle and Ahab dies. The point is, all leaders want to know what's coming. All leaders are always looking for information that it borderlines on divine knowledge. You guys understand, right, why Mark Zuckerberg is a billion gazillionaire, right? Right? It's not because Mark Zuckerberg made the internet fun. It's not because he built some fun website and platform and app that we all download on our phones. And it's not because he allowed us to, I mean, you got to be a little older to know about this. Like, you remember back in the day, you could poke your friends and send messages. And yeah, some of you kids are like, I don't know what he's talking about. It was a Facebook thing. Some of you kids probably don't even know what Facebook is. It's kind of an old person thing now. It's not because he gave us some free product that we all enjoyed using. That's not how he became a billionaire. He became a billionaire because he figured out how to get billions of people to give personal information to him for free. Information most of us didn't even realize we were giving him. He figured out how to take the power of computer processing and algorithms and pay closer attention to our lives than we pay attention to our lives. And then he amasses all of this data and he sells it to the highest bidder. But I'm telling you, it is shocking what the internet knows about you. I want to read you Psalm 139, first four verses, and then I want to borrow the language for a minute if I can. Psalm 139, this is what is predicated about the knowledge of God. O Lord, you have searched me and know me. You know when I sit down, when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all of my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all together. Let me borrow that language for just a moment if I can. Mark has searched you, and he knows your profile. He knows when you sit down and when you rise up. His algorithms can predict with an incredible degree of accuracy what you will think on any given subject before you've had the thought yourself. He knows your paths because of GPS. He's got a pretty good idea of where you're headed. And he knows when you go to bed. He's very acquainted with all your ways. Even before a post is on the internet, he's got a pretty good idea of what you will say. If borrowing biblical language to talk about Mark makes you a little uncomfortable, how about I do something a little more festive? He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. And he's going to sell it to the highest bidder. Mark Zuckerberg is a billionaire because he is one of the greatest Chaldeans the world has ever seen. He's a purveyor of information in the information age, where information is the tool and the power. Understand what social media, what Google, all these major conglomerations, the sort of information and knowledge that they have about us 30 years ago, we would have said only God could know that. The sort of information that they hold and the ways in which they can manipulate it and manipulate you, that sort of power in the ancient world would have made them be worshipped like a god. That is no hyperbole. All right, everybody take a breath. I'm not going to preach a downer sermon on Thanksgiving Sunday. Relax. Let me offer you a word of encouragement, can I? From that great religious thinker, Darth Vader. Yes, I'm going to quote Star Wars to you. I'm just going to assume this morning that it's enough out in the culture that you'll understand what I'm saying. And at this point, like really, if you haven't seen Star Wars, what rock are you living under? I mean, really, in the first movie, New Hope, Darth Vader, who is one of the main antagonists in the tale, they have built the Death Star. It is a giant space station the size of a small moon, and it has, we'll call it a death ray, powerful enough to destroy a planet. And there's a scene where Darth Vader is sitting at, let's call it a council of war, with other generals and leaders are sitting around this table, and they are discussing how to use this incredible weapon that they have made. And what Vader says, do not be too proud of this technological terror you have created. Hope Mark Zuckerberg's listening. He's always listening. Don't be too proud of this technological terror you have created. The ability to destroy a planet is insignificant next to the power of the Force. Have you thought about that? It's quite a statement. The ability to destroy a planet is insignificant next to the power of the Force. Let me translate that back into some Christianese. If I hear it right, Darth Vader and the wise guys in Daniel are all saying the same thing, that as impressive as technology is, especially in the information age, there are always problems for which only God is the solution. There will always be problems that you can't think your way through. You can't advance technology to compensate. There will always be God-sized problems. You will always be trying to get information that's just not accessible. Or maybe I say it a different way. In the information age, what might be most necessary for a church in exile is not more information, as important as it is, but wisdom. Wisdom. And that may be the thing the church has not paid enough attention to. Daniel role models this well for us in the rest of the story. The king freaks out. He sends out the chief of the guard to go round up all the wise guys and have them executed. He comes to get Daniel and his friends, and Daniel says, hey, whoa, slow down. What's the rush here, buddy? What's the problem? Notice verse 14, Daniel replied with prudence and discretion. Wisdom. He responds with prudence and discretion to Arioch. Arioch tells him the problem. Daniel says, then take me to the king. Daniel is taken to the king, and note what he does. He doesn't argue with crazy. The Chaldeans tried that. It didn't work. They tried to reason with somebody being unreasonable. It wasn't an effective strategy. He doesn't argue with crazy. He accepts the premise and he says, okay, king, you tell me the time when you want me to come back with the answer. Hear the repetition of that word time? The king accused the Chaldeans of playing for time. It didn't work. Daniel comes in and says, then you appoint the time. I think he's playing for time too. And the king grants it to him. Daniel gets what the Chaldeans could not. Maybe because he responds with prudence and discretion. Then Daniel went back to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his discipleship band. Okay, the ESV doesn't actually say that. The ESV says his companions. But I think I can get away with that translation because from this part in the text to chapter 7 is all written in Aramaic, and I didn't study Aramaic. So I'm going to go with it, and it's fine. But I don't think it's incidental that these guys show up in the story, is it? Can I just say, it might be really, really important if the church is going into an exile situation to have a small group of people whom you trust implicitly, who you're all on the same spiritual path, right? Because these are the same guys in chapter 1 who said, hey, let's not compromise. Even if it costs us our lives, we're not going to do it. So they're on the journey of holiness together, and these are the guys Daniel gathers together and says, hey, boys, we have a problem. It's time to pray. I don't think that's incidental. I think it's central to the story. We need people in our lives that we're going to pray together, to read God's word together, to do life together. You want to survive in exile, you should probably have companions. You should probably have a discipleship band. Okay, I'll get off the soapbox. And then he told them to seek mercy from God of heaven concerning this mystery. They pray about it. They go to bed. In a vision of the night, God gives Daniel everything he needs. He sees the dream. He knows the interpretation. And do not miss Daniel's response. This is so key. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. The king might think he's setting the clock. It may look like the king is setting the clock. God's pulling all the strings. He sets times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise. That's important. And knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise. This is a thanksgiving psalm, is what it is. To you, O God, I give thanks and praise. Why? For you have given me wisdom and might, and have made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. He prays, God gives, and he says thanks. If the most important thing for a church in an exilic context, which I think we're entering, in the information age, if the most important thing in that situation is wisdom, well, good news. All you have to do is ask. Because wisdom isn't stuff we just conjure up on our own. It's not smarts. It's not just knowing more or reading more books. That's information. That's fine. It's good. but it is no substitute for wisdom. He prays, he receives, and he gives thanks. Can I just tell you, church, that's a pretty simple formula for going hopefully into the future for the church. We just need to commit ourselves again and again and again to pray for wisdom. Lord, give us wisdom. Lord, teach us how to live. Help us to understand how to live in this changing world that seems crazy and it's outside of the scope of my understanding. I'm not smart enough for this, but God, you have wisdom. You can give it. I need it. And then when I get it, I say thank you, because I needed that. It's that simple. I didn't say it was easy, but I do believe it is that simple. God has all wisdom, and he will generously give you everything you need for wherever his will takes you in life. You can take that to the bank. It's the promise of God. The rest of the story highlights the difference in character between the different actors, especially Daniel and Arioch. So Daniel goes to Arioch. He says, I got the answer. Arioch takes Daniel, rushes to the palace, and in haste, Arioch runs in. And notice how Arioch is trying to promote himself here. He says, oh, king, I know you've really been upset about this. Guess what? I've found the answer to your problem. He's not even the guy. He said, well, it's okay. I found the guy. And then he brings Daniel in. And when he describes Daniel, he says, I found the guy. He's one of those exile Jews. You know, the exiles from Judea. He's one of those guys. He doesn't even mention him by name. Isn't it interesting, though, in chapter 1, the question is, can we maintain our identity as a distinct people of God when we're deeply embedded in the empire? Isn't it interesting in chapter 2, the self-promoting Arioch identifies him as the distinct people of God, an exile from Judah. The king asked Daniel, can you tell me? Daniel says, no. I can't tell you, because your other wise guys, they weren't wrong. No man can tell you what you want to know, but there is a God in heaven, and this is what they got wrong. He speaks. He gives wisdom. And he will give the king the answer. So you notice Arioch comes in trying to promote himself at the expense of Daniel. Daniel comes in humbly. He says, I don't have any answers for you. God has answers. I'm just the deliverer. I'm just bringing it. And then you notice by the end of the story, Arioch isn't mentioned again, but Daniel gets exalted. Something else I find interesting is that as soon as Daniel is exalted, when Daniel finds the spotlight on him, he brings a small group into it, doesn't he? It's like he never really has his eyes on himself, not like Nebuchadnezzar does. He doesn't have that ego problem. He brings his buddies along, and everybody in exile is blessed because of Daniel's wisdom and what God has given. I really do think it's essentially that simple. It's not easy. This sort of situation where the king has flipped his lid and he's ready to kill everybody, can you imagine the sort of anxiety you'd feel? Like you weren't even in the room when this decision was made. You didn't do anything. But even in exile, even in incredibly difficult situations, God will give you everything you need. So if you hear one thing this morning, one thing, let it be this. We must commit ourselves to pray for wisdom. Wait for God to give it to us. And then simply say thank you.